Hey guys, you know how on Tea and Gemstones we talk about cursed gemstones, diamond thefts, and the history of jewels that involve mysterious circumstances? Well, that's pretty entry-level spooky and shadowy. If you want to level up your creepy and hear tales of true crime, the supernatural, and urban legends, all told with a sprinkling of comedy and camaraderie, check out the podcast Hauntings, Homicide, and Hearsay. It's hosted by Stephen and Ashley Thomas, and for my people that love to listen to podcasts all day long, they release two episodes every week, sharing the focus on true crime and the supernatural. Give Hauntings, Homicide, and Hearsay a try, but be warned, the content is explicit, unnerving, and addicting. Find the show wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, hello, everyone. Hi, come on in. Welcome to Tea and Gemstones, your shiny podcast home for all things history, science, and social commentary about gemstones, jewelry, and precious metals. I am your host, Jen, the jewelry historian with a deep love of details and all things sparkly. Thanks, guys, for leaving ratings and reviews, and of course, tuning in to listen. This is part two of the story of silver. For too long, silver has been the forgotten stepchild of the precious metal family, shunted to the side in favor of gold or platinum. I feel strongly that it is time for silver to receive its deserved credit for its importance and value to our world, both historically in the past and all the amazing ways silver plays a part in our present and our future. In part one, we laid out the baseline, where silver comes from, how mankind began discovering it, and the first known artifacts rendered in the beautiful, glimmering gray metal. But now, we are looking to more recent history, venturing into the present, and y'all, I promise, you are going to appreciate silver a lot more than you thought you ever could once you hear what I have to say. Once human civilization and technology advanced, people started discovering more of the complex qualities of silver beyond just its ability to be made into beautiful objects. Modern-day silver is a workhorse. Silver is mankind's friend, like that friend you have who just knows how to do stuff. They're so handy. Silver makes our lives better and easier. Electronics, solar panels, silver's high tensile strength and ductility to create a joint between two metal pieces is apparently crucial to HVAC and plumbing. Do you want to live without air conditioning or indoor running water? From a manufacturing standpoint, silver is used as a catalyst to make two really important chemicals: ethylene oxide and formaldehyde. Ethylene oxide makes plastics from everything from hard plastics and like sandbox shovels, lawn chairs, and storage tubs to wearable plastics. Hello, polyester. Formaldehyde makes plastics as well, and resins. And yes, I'm sure everyone had the word association right when I first said it. Formaldehyde is used in embalming fluids. Yes, a bit gross, but you can't deny it's useful. You may have heard in the news over the past few months, years, about the supply chain shortages due to the pandemic and its annoyingly persistent, lingering economic effects. And a big bottleneck in the supply chain we keep hearing about over and over again are semiconductor chips. These chips are made up of two materials: conductors that, like the name suggests, conduct electricity, and insulators, things like rubber or plastic that put the brakes on electricity. I promise it's a lot more complicated than that, but come on, this is a jewelry podcast. Anyway, these semiconductor chips help make the brains for just about everything electronic. Computers, smartphones, TVs, cars, even washing machines, and LED light bulbs. And you have silver to thank for semiconductors' existence. Michael Faraday was an English physicist conducting experiments in his lab in 1833. He was investigating the effect of temperature on silver sulfide. In his own book, Experimental Researches in Electricity, Faraday wrote that the results of his silver experiment were an extraordinary case. He discovered that the hotter silver got, the better it could conduct electricity. This is the opposite of what usually happens in metals like copper, where conductivity goes way down as the temperature rises. Faraday's discovery in 1833 helped kick off a slew of scientists across Europe performing their own experiments. Breakthrough discoveries about electricity's behavior came quickly. Scientists experimented with electricity as it interacted with light, different metals, liquids, etc., with major developments of electrical properties recorded in 1839, 1873, 74, 76, 78, until 1901, when the very first semiconductor device, adorably named Cat's Whiskers, was patented. And what did it do? Well, the Cat Whiskers semiconductor helped detect radio signals. Michael Faraday's extraordinary experiments with silver helped spark the surge of interest in electrical properties of material. And ta-da! Now semiconductors perform countless tasks for us, and silver helped start that journey to our now electronically saturated world. And you know what? Here's a top prize. Silver's relationship with electricity is a winning combination that plays second fiddle to no one. Sorry, gold. Silver has the highest electrical conductivity of all metals. Are you sold yet? Do you love silver more than gold? All right. How about some more sexy data? Here's a quick rundown of some of the amazing ways silver has embedded itself into our everyday lives, quietly helping. Nobody wants to deal with an unsightly wart, right? Well, there's a very common over-the-counter treatment known as a caustic pencil. A caustic pencil contains a mixture of silver nitrate and potassium nitrate. The chemicals cauterize the skin and destroy the wart. Speaking of making things change, have you ever heard of cloud seeding? It is a form of weather modification used to try and trigger rainfall in areas desperate for water or even to fight forest fires. Silver iodide has a molecular structure comparable to ice, so silver iodide is released into the air to encourage cloud condensation. In the United States, approximately 3 tons of silver are used every year for cloud seeding. Silver was also used to make instant film, a revolutionary way to take a photograph, pioneered by Polaroid and sold from 1947 to 1983. And how about this kind of picture? An X-ray. So X-rays work when a machine sends the X-rays through your body and onto a piece of plastic coated with a gel. A very special gel containing silver, which is super sensitive to light. The X-ray connects with the gel on the plastic and creates an image. Get this, there's actually a whole industry about recycling old X-ray film for the silver that's within it. It's called silver recovery, and for about 100 pounds of X-ray film, you can extract about 10 troy ounces of silver, roughly about $150. 100 pounds of X-rays sounds like a lot until you consider that in 2018, U.S. hospitals performed approximately 152 million X-rays. So there's a lot of silver-loaded film out there to claim. Oh, you know the transition eyeglasses that seemingly like magic turn into sunglasses when you go into sunlight? Not magic. Silver. A form of silver called silver halicide, which reacts to the UV light and darkens. And hey, remember DVDs? Before streaming and downloading replaced our massive alphabetized movie collections? DVDs have a fine layer of silver on them to prolong their life as a media storage device. And if we're not staying home to watch a movie on a DVD, let's go out and socialize, which means, hopefully, putting on deodorant and sunscreen, two skincare products of many that contain silver chloride to prevent the growth of bacteria and odor thanks to silver's antimicrobial properties. And I'm not sure how to craft a clever transition to pouring yourself a nice big glass of milk. Maybe you just came home from socializing with your deodorant and sunscreen and you want a glass of milk before bed. But listen, in the days of the Wild Wild West, cowboys would drop a silver coin down into their milk bucket to prolong its life. Before refrigerators, silver-coated bottles were used. Nowadays, sealing rings on milk bottles can include a silver-based biocide to keep your milk safe from bacteria. Okay, all this antibacteria, antimicrobial talk, what is up with that? Well, besides being the blue ribbon winner for electrical conductivity and all those other nifty things silver can do, silver has a very unique characteristic that I think solidifies its position as friend and helper to mankind. It's antimicrobial. And here's what that means. It's gonna get science-y, y'all. So, ions are atoms with charges, like positive or negative. And when silver ions come in contact with something icky, like bacteria, algae, or fungi, and some viruses, the silver does this cool trick called the oligodynamic effect, which, okay, don't tune out on me. Okay, the oligodynamic effect means the silver causes the metabolism of bad germs to be, quote, adversely affected. And by affected, I mean die. I would tell my inquisitive 5-year-old daughter, silver touches the bad stuff dies, the good stuff stays safer. Again, I repeat, silver is mankind's hardworking, handy friend. Doctors and hospitals make prolific use of silver's ability to stop the bad stuff. Until the introduction of antibiotics in the early 1940s, silver colloids, colloid means a gel or a liquid, these silver liquids were the most common and powerful choice for preventing and treating infections. There's a whole array of silver-infused medical products, everything from bandages and creams to catheters. There are even ultra-thin coatings of silver on hospital door handles to cut down on germs. Many doctors and hospital staff wear lab coats embedded with silver-based compounds to prevent germs from clinging to the fabric as they go from patient to patient. Silver has even been incorporated into hard plastics like toilet seats. You might think it all sounds a little overboard, but the healthcare industry has valid reason to put forth every effort. The CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, put out data in 2018 stating that on any given day, one in 31 hospital patients has at least one healthcare-associated infection, for a scary annual total of about 1.7 million infections caught after a patient is already in the hospital. So, more silver, I say. The scientific community agrees, and scientists are still experimenting and trying to figure out more about silver's unique ability to take down bacteria. In May 2015, chemists at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem published an amazing set of findings in scientific reports. Their experiment was set up like this. They killed a sample of bacteria using silver nitrate. Then the scientists separated the dead bacteria back out of the silver solution. Next, a new batch of living bacteria were exposed to the dead bacteria. And under the microscope, the scientists witnessed a massacre. 99.9% of the living bacteria also died after coming in contact with the carcasses of the first dead bacteria. The scientists called this a zombie effect. How cool is that? The first dead bacteria had actually soaked up and internalized the silver nitrate to the point that even when there was no silver solution around, the dead bacteria acted as a silver-infused zombie killing machine attacking other living bacteria. Nanomaterial chemist Robert Hurt of Brown University, who was not involved in the research, issued an enthusiastic statement about the findings. He said that understanding the zombie effect could lead to better designs for healthcare products. Engineers may now need to figure out ways to keep dead bacteria around, acting as agents for good, keeping germs at bay. I'm excited to see what new technology can be developed to help keep people healthy, and you can bet silver is going to play a big part. These modern-day experiments are amazing, but when did humans first discover the useful antimicrobial properties of silver? Well, we aren't sure. We do know it probably wasn't too long after silver started being mined and worked. In 3000 BC, the ancient Egyptians were using silver compounds to preserve their food. We have documentation that around 1200 BC, the Phoenicians knew enough about silver's special ability to be smart enough to store water, wine, and vinegar in silver vessels to keep it fresh. Also, little interesting side note, when the Phoenicians first came to what is now Spain, they obtained so much silver they could not fit it all on their ships, and as a result used blocks of silver to weigh their anchors down instead of lead. Can you imagine? But yes, the Phoenicians were capitalizing on silver keeping their liquids clean, and in 500 BC, the Greeks and Romans were doing the same. In 400 BC, the father of Western medicine, Hippocrates, wrote about the healing properties of silver, stating that it had anti-disease properties and could aid in wounded tissue repair. So silver is highly versatile. You can make beautiful decorative objects that are amazing to look at and cherish, and also put the metal to absolute work as coins, plastics, solar panels, making our intensely electronic world possible with semiconductors, and then helping to allow all of us to live safely within the world by adversely affecting any icky stuff that gets in silver's way. Heck, silver is in space. NASA uses silver in their water purification systems for their astronauts on the International Space Station and in the space shuttle. And their water purification technology was so efficient, the system has been commercialized and is being used to help bring clean water to areas like rural Mexico and Iraq. All these uses for silver. It's a good thing this metal is abundant. I mentioned in part one of the series about how the world's silver production is right around 27,000 tons a year, with the United States of America producing a little under 1,000 tons annually. I decided to take a closer look at the U.S.'s silver production. I thought for sure the state of Nevada, a state in the western U.S., I thought Nevada would be the top producer. After all, they are known as the Silver State. But no, Nevada is actually the second largest producer of silver after, drumroll please, Alaska. If you're talking about mining in the United States, Alaska pretty much wins in every category. This one mine in Alaska called the Greens Creek Mine, it is the fifth largest producer of silver in the entire world. Alaska has a total of 5 major metal mines, bringing up just about every valuable metal you can think of. Silver and gold, yes, but also platinum, zinc, lead, tin, copper, even jade and uranium. While that is all very impressive, I'm working to keep the scope focus narrow here. This is silver's time to shine. And if we're talking about silver in the United States, Nevada has a fascinating part to play in the story. Okay, in the mid-1800s, Nevada was being used as a means to an end. People from the eastern and midwestern areas of America wanted to go further west, like to California. So they had to traipse slowly, arduously in wagons across Nevada. We have records of some Mormons camping by a swollen river who panned for gold while they waited to cross and discovering some gold, but they ultimately decided not to stay and to continue on to California. This was in 1850, the epic 49ers year had just happened. California was the promised land. If you're not familiar with Nevada, its weather and landscape does not seem so fabled and promised. Nevada gets only about 10 inches of rainfall in a good year, and temps regularly soar over 100 degrees. Would you want to stay? But in 1857, two brothers named Ethan and Hosea Grosch came to Nevada on purpose. They were originally from Pennsylvania and were trained mineralogists. The brothers had been working in the California gold fields and decided to come to Nevada and seek the next big discovery. And they found an area that seemed to have some valuable deposits. They made a claim to the land, built a little cabin on it, and then headed back to California to do paperwork, I guess, to close up their lives in California and then come back and focus on Nevada. Well, unfortunately for Ethan and Hosea, neither of them makes it back to California. They both died pretty gruesomely in different ways. Ethan had a foot injury, go septic, and he died of lockjaw. His brother Hosea got horrible frostbite crossing the Sierra Nevada mountains. His buddies wanted to do a roadside double leg amputation, and he refused, and he died. So what now? What becomes of the brothers' claim? Well, in their little cabin on their Nevada land, the brothers had left behind a chest containing ore samples and maps and documents, all the official stuff to their claim. And they'd hired a guy named Henry Comstock to live in the cabin and watch their claim and guard it from, I'm guessing, being snatched by competing prospectors. Henry Comstock he's such a fascinating character that I think if he was described in a movie or a book, you would think he was unbelievable. Henry was originally from Canada. He had worked as a fur trapper and a sheep herder and a cook, a bunch of odd jobs. He was illiterate and eccentric. He was called Old Pancake because he refused to eat risen bread and he always wore 7 belts at a time. But Henry wasn't so dense that he didn't know how to seize on a good opportunity. With the brothers gone, he took over their claim. Possession is 9/10 of the law and all that. He couldn't read the papers in the chest, but he filed for the land claim because he could tell from the ore samples the brothers collected that there was something there. 4 other men came to the area at the same time and all filed adjacent claims to Comstock and started working the area. At first, the miners were discouraged by the small amounts of gold that were inside this annoying bluish-gray quartz and sticky, putty-like blue-black material. But on June 27th, 1859, it was discovered this annoying mix of materials in the way of getting to the gold was actually an extremely rich nearly pure version of silver sulfide. This discovery is what triggered the Nevada Silver Rush, bringing in a surge of miners from the now fading gold fields of California just across one state line to Nevada. In the first 6 years, from 1859 to 1865, an estimated $50 million in silver was taken from the claims. Though, get this, an estimated 20% of that money was spent by the miners themselves in litigation, fighting each other over the land claims. But you can't blame these guys for going hard after their riches. Geologist and writer Andrew Aldean stated of this frantic time, quote, "You could shovel the mineral right off the ground and you didn't need a PhD to find it," end quote. Pardoning the dig at the miners' intelligence levels, most of these original silver miners did not make a fortune, though boy, they really tried. Processing the rich silver ore mixtures was tricky. The amalgamation, getting the actual silver out of the mixture, well, it was super difficult. And when the mining first started, people didn't know how to do it. In California, the miners had literally just been picking up nuggets of gold out of the water, out of the dirt. Now these miners, people like Henry Comstock, who probably couldn't read, weren't that educated, were trying to create complex productive chemistry on their sticky blue silver dirt mix. The experiments they conducted had a devastating and lasting effect on the natural environment. One of the ingredients used to extract the silver was mercury. It is estimated that between 1850 and 1890, more than 14 million pounds of mercury was released into the Carson River. And mercury does not go away. The river and its reservoirs are still really contaminated, with the water's cleanup and management of its mercury levels being on the national priorities list for the Environmental Protection Agency since 1990. But anyway, this process of getting all the silver out of the sludgy dirt, it was hard. Almost all of the miners ended up pretty quickly realizing the futility of going it on their own and sold their claim stakes to big mining companies who could come in and set up shop with the necessary tools and equipment and develop the correct techniques to get at the silver. Henry Comstock, though the silver lode bears his name, he was one of those miners who sold his land claim for pennies on the dollar in 1862 after failing to profitably extract silver. He went on to try and prospect unsuccessfully in both Oregon and Montana before the string of failures was too much and he committed suicide 8 years after leaving Nevada in 1870. While Henry's personal story and the individual saga of the rough and tumble miners trying to find their fortune are ultimately sad stories, on the larger scale of history zoomed out from the individual, the Nevada Silver Rush was a good thing. The rapid surging of people moving into the area and the supercharged economics of silver pouring from the ground resulted in overarching prosperity for the Nevada territory. Yeah, when all this is going on, Nevada isn't a state. But hey, once the United States government saw how much money was coming out of that hot, dry land, they didn't waste much time. 1859 is when silver was really discovered, and just under 5 years later, in 1864, Nevada became the 36th state. If this whole episode, this whole series, has been me trying to give credit where credit is due for all silver has done, there is something else we can thank the Nevada Silver Rush for. How about helping to spark the creation of someone who the New York Times wrote in his obituary was, quote, "the greatest humorist the United States has produced," end quote. This author is also considered the father of American literature. His name is Samuel Clemens, or, thanks to silver, you know him as Mark Twain. Yes, Samuel was a 26-year-old riverboat pilot on the Mississippi River when his older brother Orrin was appointed the first and only Secretary of the Nevada Territory in 1861. Samuel traveled to the silver mining boomtown of Virginia City on the Comstock Lode to try and be a silver miner. Like so many others, he failed to make a profit and instead he turned to working at the local newspaper. On February 3, 1863, he wrote a humorous travel account about the mining area and signed it for the first time with his now iconic pen name, Mark Twain. He went on to write a book about his experiences in Nevada and the surrounding American West called Roughing It, where he actually details the grueling process of trying to refine the silver ore. He writes of attempting to pulverize the silver putty with sledgehammers and then dumping it in heated tubs combined with various amounts of chemicals, water, and salt. I think his calling was definitely more towards writing than mining. He went on to write what are considered to be the great American novels, books thought to embody the essence of America, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Also, fun little fact, The Adventures of Tom Sawyer was one of the very first novels to be written on a typewriter. Did the discovery of silver lead to a booming economy for a new territory and subsequently to a government official's baby brother coming to try and make his fortune and ultimately him writing for a local paper and finding recognition and acclaim to become one of the most beloved authors of all time? I say yes. Thank you, silver, for being so tricky to mine in Nevada. I know that Samuel Clemens probably would still have become Mark Twain anyway, but there is no denying his time in the Wild West of the Nevada Silver Rush helped shape him. For all this historical analysis and scientific assessment, guys, in the end, this is Tea and Gemstones. This is a jewelry podcast. We got to talk about silver and its part in modern day jewelry. I think it is pretty obvious the characteristic of silver that does not endear it to some, especially when choosing a material for their jewelry. Silver tarnishes. There just isn't dodging around the fact. I'll quote directly from the Tiffany & Co. website from their FAQ about sterling silver jewelry. They say, quote, "Sterling silver tarnishes when exposed to salty air, chlorine, sulfur, humidity, perspiration, cosmetics, household bleach, and other strong chemicals," end quote. Yeah, so the tarnish that is happening, the silver itself is reacting with the sulfur and all those things I just listed, and forming an appropriately named chemical called silver sulfide. And silver sulfide is black. The darkening of your silver chain or silver ring is the thin silver sulfide layer building. One thing I do like about silver is the more you wear it, it polishes itself clean against your skin, avoiding tarnish buildup. But it is understandably not people's favorite thing when they open their jewelry box to retrieve a sterling silver jewelry piece they haven't worn in a while to discover it's transformed to the dark side. This tarnishing is 100% reversible with a couple different methods, such as the classic silver polishing or dipping in cleaners. My personal favorite way to clean tarnished silver makes science do the work for you. You boil a pot of water containing baking soda and a large piece of aluminum foil. Submerge your tarnished silver into the pot at a rolling boil for about a minute. Strain out the piece and you'll be astounded how bright and white it is. That's because you made a chemical reaction between the foil, baking soda, water, and your metal. The silver sulfide reacted to the aluminum, and to say it in super simple terms, the tarnish falls off your metal and instead floats in the water. You can put your now gorgeous silver teapot or earrings in pride of place and look down in the water to see little pale yellow flakes of sulfide drifting in the water. All this to say, yeah, it's really annoying when your silver jewelry turns black. And however you clean your silver, it's a hassle compared to gold and platinum, two metals that can shamelessly flaunt the fact that they never tarnish or dull. But let's weigh some options here, some pros and cons. Let's say you want to buy an 18-inch curb chain, a basic classic staple of a jewelry box. Let's say we want to buy the chain from James Avery. James Avery is a mid-sized artisan jewelry company known to have fair prices, so we aren't dealing with much of the like, you're paying for the brand name vibe, like you get with Tiffany's or Cartier. So an 18-inch curb chain from James Avery in sterling silver will cost you $54. In 14-karat yellow gold, the exact same design costs $695, about 13 times more expensive. Now, yes, gold is more expensive for lots of reasons, and I love yellow gold. It is stronger and more durable than silver. More on that in a moment. I own lots of gold, but for kind of the staples, the basics of the jewelry box, curb chains, hoop earrings, bracelets, I do not think it's justified for people turning their noses up at silver. For the price, I'll happily give my pieces a polish every once in a while. However, silver, while a gorgeous metal, is not suited for all types of jewelry. And this is because pure, true silver is soft. Not soft like it's romantic and tender and cries easily. Soft like if you picked up a pure silver bar, you could bend it with your hands or indent it with your fingernail. This form of silver is often called fine silver and is stamped with a 999 to indicate it is 99.9% silver. If you buy silver bars as investment pieces, they'll be pure silver. But this is way too soft and malleable to be used in jewelry, sculpture, or really anything other than sitting in a box. Enter sterling silver. Sterling silver is technically a metal alloy, which means it isn't pure, it's a mix of metals. It's still almost all silver, 92.5% actually. The remaining 7.5% is copper or zinc. Here's where some of silver's ill-deserved bad image reputation comes in. Non-reputable jewelers, or just trashy jewelry you buy at the mall, I'm talking like Forever 21 or Claire's, that so-called sterling silver can have nickel in it. I've heard so many people say, oh, I can't wear sterling silver, I'm allergic to nickel. Okay, obviously you shouldn't wear nickel if you're allergic to it, but don't throw sterling silver under the bus, because 14-karat white gold, the most common metal for engagement rings, they're an alloy containing about 11% nickel. Again, I'm not dogging on gold. I just want to put the facts out there so it's a level playing field, because I think sterling silver has an undeserved poor reputation. Sterling silver doesn't have nickel in it. White gold definitely has nickel in it. There you go. Maybe I don't need to defend sterling silver. The people who know how versatile and lovely it is, those people are buying it. Sterling silver is a low-key powerhouse of profitability for retailers, both big brick-and-mortar stores and artisans selling online, due to the reasonable price point for the raw material of silver to create the jewelry in the first place. Tiffany & Co. was actually the first American company to institute the 0.925 sterling silver standard. This was in the 1860s, at the height of the Gilded Age, when people had money and were looking to indulge, to spend it, and to show off their wealth. Enter sterling silver, which had recently been discovered in abundance in the western United States. A lot of Tiffany's first work with the cool gray metal was in hollowware, vases, and display pieces. But fast forward to 1974, jewelry designer Elsa Peretti joins Tiffany & Co. and she makes sterling silver jewelry the epitome of her vibe. Her sculptural designs for over 30 years were so popular, many of them are still in production today. On the Tiffany's website under the filter Elsa Peretti Sterling Silver, you get 382 product results, ranging from a $9,000 bone cuff inlaid with turquoise or a $7,000 flexible snake belt to the iconic bean pendant necklace for $275. Other jewelry designers have taken sterling silver and continue to elevate the metal's prestige. David Yarman was born in 1942 on Long Island and was originally a sculptor. He wasn't actually a sculptor. He's a person who made sculptures. And he created a sterling silver design for his wife, which was noticed by a gallery owner who asked if he could sell the design. In 1983, Yarman introduced his now iconic cable bracelet, a cuff of double helix sterling silver ropes tipped with finial ends of gemstones or precious metals. In 1997, Yarman became the first high-end designer to set diamonds in sterling silver. Even today, as of when I'm writing this, March 2022, if you go to the David Yarman website and type diamonds into the search bar, then set the filter that you only want the material to be sterling silver, you still get 415 results. And of course, y'all know me, the first thing I do is go over to sort by and check out the highest and lowest priced items. The entry-level piece is called a Cable Classics Cross Pendant and is set with a 0.03 carat weight diamond. The highest piece, a sterling silver necklace strung with black diamond faceted beads, retailing for $45,000. Besides the glamour and bling of high jewelry houses, sterling silver jewelry has been adopted by those who considered themselves out of the mainstream. Groups like heavy metal rockers, rock and roll, bikers, and punks. Silver's affordable price point and easy ability to be crafted into any shape has allowed for members of subcultures to adopt silver as the medium to display their gothic crosses, skulls, snakes, and chains. One of silver's perhaps cons, the fact that it is easily scratched and dented, is actually in this instance considered a point of pride. Bikers and rockers have an aversion towards jewelry that looks too shiny and new. They pride themselves on their silver pieces looking lived in, the scratches, nicks, and tarnishings proudly displayed as proof their jewelry has accompanied them loyally through their journey of life. One of my favorite jewelry brands that caters to this lifestyle is The Great Frog. They're based in London but have a handful of shops worldwide and have been lucky enough to visit the New York City location. One of my favorite unique items The Great Frog makes are their eye rings. They're actually hand-painted prosthetic eyes set either horizontally or vertically on a hefty band of sterling silver with realistic eyelashes etched onto the edges. I've talked about the belief of wearing an evil eye in jewelry for protection, and there's no more beautiful way to do that than with one of the Great Frog's eye rings. I can't help but think of the TV show Friends and their theme song, I'll Be There For You by the Rembrandts. The chorus stating over and over, I'll be there for you. I feel like that's what silver is. It's there for us. No matter what mankind needs or wants to do, everything from creating currency to growing developing civilizations, crafting beautiful objects to honor royalty, religions, and romance, to develop technology to take x-rays, make clouds rain, create semiconductors, form our clothes, and heck, even heal our physical wounds. And oh yeah, silver is malleable, shiny, gorgeous, and abundant, perfect for creating exquisite jewelry, both easily wallet accessible and as high-end fantasy as possible. Sure, we always love to go for the gold, but silver should play no second place in your heart. It deserves a top podium finish. I mean, heck, Olympians get gold medals, but Super Bowl winners get the Vince Lombardi trophy, and that thing is made out of 7 pounds of sterling silver, crafted by none other than Tiffany's. The story of silver began before recorded history, and it is far from over. Both in the labs of scientists and in the workshop of jewelers and metalsmiths, silver is continuing to be there for us, being the helpful, beautiful, valuable, precious metal it is. That's all for this episode of Tea and Gemstones. We've closed out this series. Are you a fan of sterling silver now, and you've listened to both episodes and you fully disagree? Well, tell me about it. I promise I can take it. Head over to Instagram at Tea and Gemstones and leave me a comment under the grid post for this episode. Please, please, if you like listening to the show, please leave a review and a rating on your listening platform. That direct feedback is what keeps Tea and Gemstones alive in the algorithm so people can browse and find the podcast. If you're wanting more episodes, check out the show Patreon. The link is in the episode notes. And you get access to a full exclusive library of extra episodes found nowhere else. Our theme song is by Joseph McDade with additional music work by Audionautics. As always, I have been your host, Jen, and it has been a pleasure hanging out with you. Until next time, everyone, stay sparkly.